From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, using behavioral science to give us a nudge.
The groceries that are at eye level in the grocery store aren't there by accident. People are paying to put those products there because they know eye level is an implied default, the status quo.
A new novel by Michigan writer John Smolens explores what life was like at a POW camp in the Upper Peninsula during World War II.
There were incidents where other prisoners would be injured, and there were incidents where they would be killed.
We continue the conversation with writer Shaka Sengor about his journey to a new life and a new self through 19 years in Michigan prisons.
Like, it was heartbreaking to know that my child was seeing me as a monster, because a murderer to a child is a monster.
Those stories and more today on Stateside, but first, the news. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How does government typically work? Well, historically, pretty much along this line, land on an idea that seems like a good idea. Do it. And maybe it works, and maybe it doesn't. A perfect example of the latter would be the Flint water crisis. Somehow, the idea of saving $100 a day by not adding corrosion control chemicals seemed like a good idea to someone at the time. And we know how that turned out. There are countless cases of money spent by government on efforts that may work or may not. And that's why we're seeing governments turning to something called a nudge unit, using insights about the way we behave to help politicians determine policy. How do they work, and are they able to tackle some of our biggest problems? Joe Arvai is the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the School of Natural Resources. He also directs the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. It's always good to see you here, Joe.
It's delightful to be back. Thank you.
This idea of a nudge unit, I guess what, began in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, that's right. Preceding that, there has been a lot of interest in looking at behavioral insights and how we actually make our decisions and behave as human beings. And to try and tap into that, early on, the emphasis was on correcting our behaviors, identifying things that we did well, reinforcing those, identifying things where we struggled, and trying to correct those. And then what came about around 2008, popularized in 2008 with the publication of a book called Nudge, was the idea of seizing upon our predictable biases and our predictable tendencies in decision-making to help us make choices in our own self-interest without us really even knowing that it was happening. So, of course, government jumped on this as an opportunity to see if they could make us wealthier, healthier, and so on.
So give me an idea how it's been used in England, and then you were saying that this idea has really grown around the globe.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. So one thing that we know from behavioral science is that people like to kind of fall back on the status quo or on defaults when they're making decisions. So if we're presented with a default or a status quo alternative, that instinctively feels right. There's sort of an implicit endorsement in looking at a status quo and accepting it.
So as my late mother-in-law from Ireland used to say, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Precisely. Absolutely precisely. So if we look at something like organ donation rates, if you look at organ donation rates in North America, somewhere between 20% and 30% is considered to be quite good. And the reason for this is that if you want to become an organ donor, you go to the DMV when you get your license, mm-hmm. and it says, if you want to be an organ donor, check this box. And you actually have to read it, you have to understand it, you have to think about it, then you have to take action and check that box. In Europe, what they've done is they've basically said, hey, when you come in to get your driver's license, you are an organ donor. And if you don't want to be an organ donor, check this box. And that simple shift to moving organ donation to the default leads to organ donation rates in Europe at around 90 to 100%.
Because it's just there, so you don't have to stop and think about the fact you may die.
Absolutely. So governments have now run with this, and they've said if we want to get people to invest in savings and retirement plans, when you're hired by certain employers, the default now is you're automatically enrolled in this plan. It's sort of a one-size-fits-all plan, so at least you're getting something.
But this is influencing the public without us knowing it, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and there's a lot of hue and cry about whether or not this is ethical or appropriate. I think the thing to keep in mind when you think about a nudge unit is the environment in which we make decisions is providing us with context no matter what. So the idea is, from a policy perspective, if we can then take some active control of that, modify the environment in such a way that people will make choices in their best interests. And here's the key, without curtailing their ability to choose something else if they want, without sort of increasing the transaction cost of making that different choice.
Because this is not a dictatorship.
Exactly. Then it works. So the argument is, with something like that organ donation form, how hard is it to check that box and not be an organ donor? The argument is not very hard. So it's not kind of coercive in that regard.
You say there's sometimes a nudge really isn't enough, such as...
Yeah, and this is the important thing. So when we look at the big, complicated decisions that we make, ones that involve multiple stakeholders, long time horizons, lots of uncertainty.
Like global warming, global climate change.
Yeah, yep. Global warming is a key example. I think what happened in Flint, as you alluded to in your intro, is a fantastic example. If we look at what we're doing with the refugee crisis in Syria, these are decisions where you can't sort of put something at proverbial kind of eye level or default level. These kinds of decisions involve a heavy lift. They involve thinking about consequences in ways that we're not accustomed to thinking about it. And in fact, just to use the example from earlier, our propensity to love the status quo actually hurts us in these situations, because we'll just look to Syria or Flint or whatever and say, hey, this is what we've always done in the past. It hasn't really bitten us hard before. So let's do it again. What's the harm? And then every so often, something like Flint comes along and shows us.
And you talk about something called active decision support for these kind of heavy lift issues. What is that and how does that work?
Well, basically, active decision support means that we have to modify the processes we use when we make choices. So if we go back to nudges, I call those passive decision support because you don't even really know they're happening. You don't have to think. You just go with your gut and make decisions. And if the engineer who made the environment in which you're choosing did a good job, then you're going to be making good choices. Active decision support basically involves taking a complicated problem, breaking it up into manageable parts, and working with a decision maker step by step by step through that process so that they can make a better and more defensible decision. The kicker is, when it comes to nudge units, governments have jumped on this, as I said, and they're saying, hey, this is an area where we need specialized expertise. Let's invest in that. The assumption with active decision support is, if you're smart and intelligent and experienced, you should be able to do this on your own. The science tells us not even close. So why not invest in these kinds of insights in government as well?
What might this look like then? Let's talk about our globe and about our climate. And how might this active decision support work for helping us be able to influence things?
Active decision support involves a few key components that science has shown us can be very effective. The first is, it helps us to think about the problems and opportunities that we're confronting. A lot of times we make assumptions about the problem that's in front of us or the opportunity that we're facing and think that we know what's going on there. We think we know what the boundaries are around it. We think we know who the stakeholders and the important players in that decision ought to be, and we proceed. We don't really stop and ask ourselves, hey, is this really the right choice we ought to be making? Secondly, we find that people don't do a very good job of articulating what it is they want to get out of those decisions. We don't think about our values and we don't think about our objectives as precursors to making decisions. From that, we don't then think about how we actually measure success. So we go into decisions both with an uneven and sort of ill-defined playing field and without a very good idea of what it is that we're hoping to get. And then to your point about Flint, we also see that people don't like to think about alternatives. They jump on one thing as the way to go. They might tag a few ornaments on that and think that it's a little bit different, but they don't give themselves the opportunity to evaluate a wide spread of alternatives in a creative and thoughtful way.
Yeah, those bureaucratic blinders were on in a big way.
Absolutely. And it's not uncommon, and it's not unique to Flint for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's not a sign of maliciousness. I mean, I don't know the legal ins and outs of the Flint case or other cases, but for most of the decisions that I've worked on, there is no kind of nefarious individual. Yeah,
yeah,
there's no one in there trying to mess with you. It's really just how we instinctively do it, and we kind of proceed. I'll tell you one other thing. One thing that people really hate to do is make trade-offs. So if you have to give something up to get something else that you value, but for different reasons, that creates a conflict. And the easiest way to resolve that conflict is to ignore it. So once again, we start making decisions based on single variables. What's the cheapest? What's the fastest? What's the perceived safest? Without really thinking about how much safety do we give up for this saving? How much sort of long-term flexibility do we lose in return for this particular saving? So it's hard.
So in an ideal world, Joe, would state governments have a active decision support team there to help advise policy decisions? How might this work in the real world?
You know what? I think you nailed it. I think that's exactly what needs to happen. And it's happening in other domains. So if you look at government offices and their marketing and communications teams, they've got specialists that know how the public responds to messages, and they work with the team, with the politicians, with the bureaucrats to craft messages in a constructive and defensible way. With the passive decision support stuff, we see these people skilled in behavioral science who are there helping to inform policy. When it comes to the decisions that require the heavy lift, we don't see that. We have this sort of assumption that, again, smart people with good intentions will do the right thing, and there isn't that capability there. So what I'm arguing for, and what I've been arguing for quite some time, is to begin to build that capacity in government, in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector, starting with small offices of people who are there to help structure these complicated decisions for people.
I love the term you use, choice architects.
Yeah, and that's kind of the buzzword that's out there. And again, it's all about engineering that environment in which people choose on the passive side. But listen, a choice architect can also help you structure the process you use to make those complicated decisions.
But there's a dangerous line that could be crossed.
Absolutely, and it's being crossed. So I think, you know, if you look at it from the standpoint of what governments are doing, they're trying to serve your best interests, or at least that's what the nudge units say their mission is. If you cross the line into the private sector, it becomes marketing and consumer choice. And listen, let's not be fooled by the fact that the groceries that are at eye level in the grocery store aren't there by accident. People are paying to put those products there because they know eye level is an implied default at the status quo. That's why the magazines are at the checkout counter and not in the back of the store. So you can really take advantage of this stuff to get people to do what you want. I think the key with choice architecture, whether it's on the passive side or the active side, is to always maintain freedom of choice. It's not about prescribing an alternative. It's about helping you make choices that are in your own best interest. And I know people are going to listen to this and think, wow, that's crazy. This is dangerous. He's crazy. This can be done right. And that's what I'm hoping for.
The piece that Joe wrote is in theconversation.com. Society's biggest problems need more than a nudge. Joe Arvai is the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the School of Natural Resources at the University of Michigan, where he also directs the Herb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. Great ideas, Joe. Thank you so much for sharing them with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a new novel by Michigan writer John Smolens explores what life was like at a POW camp in the Upper Peninsula during World War II.
There were incidents where other prisoners would be injured, and there were incidents where they would be killed.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are not too many books that can serve up history, suspense, crime, and a love story all beautifully tied together. One such book is Wolf's Mouth. Author John Smolens is a former professor at Northern Michigan University, where he helped to found their MFA program. Wolf's Mouth starts out in World War II, and it follows the story of Italian prisoner of war Francesco Verdi, who's held in a POW camp in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. John Smolens is with us now from Marquette. John, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks very much, Cynthia.
I got to tell you, I just love this story. It just was the thing that you kind of don't think of, like, wow, we forgot that we had World War II POW camps in Michigan. How did this whole idea come to you?
Well, I, like most people, I didn't know about these camps until maybe about a dozen years ago. There was a series of articles in the local paper here in Marquette, the Mining Journal, which discussed one camp in particular, which is in Autrain, which is a little village maybe 20 to 25 miles east of here. And, you know, this is the kind of story that novelists sort of tuck in the back of their minds and say, there's some potential there. And quite frankly, I didn't, you know, sit down and start writing the story right away. But over time, I kept coming back to it, and I do love to read history, and I started to read about the period and learned that there were camps here in Michigan, and I was interested in what the conditions were, how the men were treated, what their response to their experience was. And then really over a number of years, it took a long time to write this book, I finally got to the point where I said, you know, this is the next one that I'm going to work on.
So you actually used one of these camps as the camp for your novel, Wolf's Mouth.
Yes. In the UP, there were five camps. In the state of Michigan, there were a total of 32. And up here, the closest one to Marquette, where I live, is in Autran. So I'm writing about a camp that really did exist. So that is really a part of history. But naturally, it is a novel. The characters depicted in the story are purely fictional because they're both American soldiers as well as European prisoners. The narrator, Francesco Verdi, is a fictional character. He is a captain in the Italian army who is captured in the north of Africa in 1943. The rest of the characters are purely fictional, but the place is real. Autran's camp did exist.
Well, I'm interested in your research, John. Did you find, did we have many Italian prisoners in Michigan during the war? Because we, as you point out very deftly in the novel, there was certainly a strong Italian population already in the UP.
Here in the UP, a number of the towns have sizable Italian-American populations, yes. They came here probably several generations ago, in many cases because of the mining. There were certain camps, and I'm speaking about the whole country for a moment, where there were over 170 camps, POW camps, throughout the United States. Most of the camps had a mix of prisoners, a mix coming from different European countries. Some camps, they did tend to group a certain nationality in one place. But as far as I can tell, here in the UP, they really sort of mixed them up. Now, naturally, there would be more German soldiers than the other nationalities. For the sake of the story, I wanted to have just two Italian prisoners, the narrator and his one good friend, Adino. The vast majority of the other prisoners are German. There are a few Poles, a few Hungarians, and one Russian who does enter into the story.
And very fascinating. And I think this is a good time to ask you if you'll read an excerpt, John Smolins, from your novel Wolf's Mouth. And this is kind of early in the story, which is seen through the eyes of this Italian captain, prisoner of war, Francesco Verdi. And something odd has happened. One of the German prisoners has not returned home in time for dinner. So could you read us an excerpt?
Certainly. What we learned from other camps in the U.S. made most of us thankful that we were in Autran. The Americans weren't the problem, it was the Nazis. They succeeded in taking over a camp, terrorizing any German prisoner who had been a social democrat before the war, or anyone who was not convincingly pro-Hitler. There were stories about other breaks that had occurred before I arrived at Autran. Communication between the five camps in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan was frequent, particularly with Camp Eveleth, which was not far from far to the east. But there were stories about men walking into nearby towns. Evidently, many of the Americans living in the UP weren't even aware that the prisoners of war were being held in camps out in the woods. So on several occasions, prisoners who entered a town were treated cordially, despite the fact that they were either wearing the military uniform of a foreign country or wearing a prisoner's outfit, which included the letters PW on their shirts and trousers. In such cases, a member of the local law enforcement would be notified by the prison command, and soon the prisoners would be escorted back to camp, often to be greeted as though they'd been on a pleasant holiday. But one break from a Michigan prison had been somewhat successful. Several prisoners escaped, and though most were quickly picked up, two of them were not. It soon became clear that they were on the run with one of the guards. Often, when they were drawing maps in the dirt, there would be speculation about how these three might get out of the United States and return to Europe. Some, who paid little attention to maps, insisted that they could sail from San Francisco and cross the Atlantic. Adino suggested that they might swim to Cuba. I didn't understand why they would want to go back to Europe, at least until the war was over. But then I didn't have a wife and children. like many of the men, and my parents and sister, who wrote to me regularly, seemed safe in their villa in Macerata. I was most curious about whatever possessed the American guard who ran off with these two prisoners.
That is writer John Smolin's reading an excerpt from his new novel, Wolf's Mouth, set in a prisoner of war camp in Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, right there during World War II. And so we have the history, we have love in the sense that Captain Verity meets a lovely young Upper Peninsula woman named Kiara, and the love part of the story. And then the suspense and crime elements, you do them so well, John, in the form of the Nazi commander Vogel, who runs the camp. Do we know whether this kind of thing happened, where you had the high Nazi officer kind of keeping order among the prisoners and laying down the law?
Yes. In my research, and this probably was one of the reasons I really became intrigued by this idea, the camps often broke down where a small percentage of the German prisoners were very ardent Nazis, and they did take control, and they ruled in a very iron-fisted fashion. And there were incidents where other prisoners would be injured, and there were incidents where they would be killed. The other means of controlling the prisoners was by sending word back to Germany, threatening families and loved ones and so forth, which they could do through the mail. They were allowed to write back home, and they had various means of coding messages within a letter so that they could get by the authorities who would look at the mail. That is not fictional. There were instances in many of the camps around the United States where the Nazis really ruled very severely.
That was a surprise to me, and I consider myself quite a student of World War II, but you really do turn it in very, very well to a detective and crime novel, in a sense. Francesco and Chiara eventually get to Detroit, and they become Frank and Claire Green and build a good life for themselves. And I wonder, do we know if that kind of thing happened, where people were able to morph into a real American identity and live under the radar?
Well, after the war, there were, from my reading, about 2,200 prisoners were unaccounted for. Most prisoners, when they escaped, they were returned, or in some cases returned to camps on their own. However, there were just over 2,000 who somehow had slipped through the cracks. In many cases, they wanted to stay in the United States. They changed their identities, and they did succeed in working their way into the fabric of American life. They very often married American women. They had jobs. They had homes. They paid their taxes. They were law-abiding citizens. And in many instances, they remained in the United States undetected for years, which is the case with Francesco, who becomes Frank Green.
It's fascinating. And Francesco really finds himself caught really in the jaws of a pincher, American justice and Nazi vengeance. And I'm not going to give a lot away, because it's fascinating. And I didn't know as a reader really where you were going to take me. It's a wonderfully drawn story. And I'm wondering, John, when you have a story like this and it's very lots of twists and turns, do you have a roadmap or a storyboard, if you will, or do the story and the characters lead you?
It's the latter. I have great respect and admiration for writers who tell me that they can sit down and outline an entire novel and then proceed to write it out. I can't do that. I have to sort of find my way in the dark, so that I write many drafts. Early drafts, I make a lot of wrong turns. I think usually a story is going well when I feel like it's being told to me and I'm recording it. I think as I've gotten older, I've come to trust the voice of the characters more than when I was younger, and particularly in this case, because this is a first-person narration, I really came to trust Francesco's voice throughout the telling of the story.
You grew up in Massachusetts, John, and I know you came to Michigan in the mid-80s to teach at Michigan State, and then 10 years later, up you went to Northern Michigan University. What has kept you in the UP ever since?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, but I mentioned Lake Superior. I have great affection for Lake Superior. I did grow up near the Massachusetts coast, and when I was a boy, I loved the ocean, and my mother lived on Cape Cod for many years. But I have to say, Lake Superior has a certain spirit that really speaks to me. I'm fortunate to live in a house that's on the bluff overlooking the lake, so I actually can sit at my desk and look over my shoulder and watch the sunrise over the lake at this time of year. And it's also the people. The Upper Peninsula is a truly unique place. Everybody talks about its natural splendors, which is all true. But the people in the Upper Peninsula are, we can endure long winters, and we love to make jokes about that. But I think that that really carries out into other aspects of our lives and the way we relate to each other. And I've considered it home for over 20 years now, and I'm not planning on going anywhere else.
John Smolin's new novel, Wolf's Mouth, and as we were exploring, it's got history, suspense, crime, a love story. I recommend it highly. Thank you so much for sharing your talent and your novel with us, John Smolin.
Thank you very much.
Listening to Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. Our series Minding Michigan explores mental health issues in our state. Today, we introduce you to Patrick Cleland, better known as Rick Chime. He's a rapper from West Michigan with new music released earlier this year. He's been collaborating with local artists all around the state and has several projects in the works. Despite his success, Chime struggles with depression, and he talks about it in his music. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia has this profile.
Those who know Rick Chime call him a wordsmith, a hip-hop poet. His newest album, Bald Since Birth, was produced with friend Nixon. Together, they mix beats with lyrics to form a blend of hip-hop and spoken word. Chime has been busy this year with collaborations, including this one with indie folk band The Accidentals.
I don't have the patience to stay here. Traveled hours in a van just to play here. And I know if we stop for too long, I might fall for this dot on the glow piece and take care.
Get me out. Then there was a dance film made to his original track called Pull Me Back off his newest album.
Beats telling me keep rhyming because it's what I need. I am sensing you're feeling that I've been whining enough.
Every time I think I found a way to get about you, pull me back.
As a kid, Chime was obsessed with basketball. He played in high school and some in college. But at the age of 15, his dad died in a plane accident, and that really changed the direction of his life.
After the plane crash happened, I submersed myself even further into basketball and at the same time into hip-hop.
Selfish, crashed in that plane, abandoned us for some reason, never sought to talk to someone with the training that could help me make some sense of what was going on inside my head.
Each song on the album tells a part of Chime's story, from the loss of his dad to where he is today. He began writing the lyrics shortly after Art Prize 2013. That's the year he performed a 17.5-hour freestyle rap.
It was in pursuit of a Guinness Book record, and that was, you could only stop for 5 seconds, and there was just consistent content coming from all these different sources.
Chime did not get that record for longest freestyle rap, but people were paying attention, and he was gaining notoriety. Still, something was off.
Here's all this love coming and almost feeling like you don't deserve it.
Chime had a feeling his depression was keeping him from truly being comfortable in his own skin, but he didn't know what to do about it.
Because I didn't love myself when I was getting all this validation from the outside. These things that I thought were going to bring happiness, and they didn't. A huge wake-up call, and once I started to do the work to break down some of the negative routines and replace them with positive, things started to fall in place.
Around the same time, Chime started working with the Mental Health Foundation of West Michigan. He was learning about mental health first aid and using his music to connect with kids.
I'm using the music as a vehicle to articulate these messages to these young people. But at the same time, I'm learning what the signs and symptoms of depression and about mental illness are myself.
Chime finally found the help he was looking for. He wrote a full-length album documenting his journey. And he says if other people can put the stigma behind them, they can get the help that they want.
And a lot of people are sitting there knowing that they could probably benefit from an outside perspective someone with professional training, there's a difference between knowing that and going and making that move to put yourself out there. And a lot of that's because of the stigma that surrounds it, and we've been taught that vulnerability isn't strength. And it's pretty much the opposite, I believe. And there's nothing wrong with going to get a coach. Don't think that you have to navigate it as a solo mission.
Chime continues to talk with young people about suicide prevention and the signs and symptoms of depression. He also mentors young rappers.
If you're with me, you should risk your mixture. Perfect your recipe dutifully, risk for bliss.
The last song on his album is called Today, and it strikes a hopeful note. Chime says he's committed to finding balance in his life, and he encourages others to do the same. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
State isn't measured by money. If I'm great, it's not because they all love me, but from work put in much prior to us meeting. I'm wondering if someone's gonna hear this and start working towards something. Start working towards something. I wipe the sleep from my eyes. Hello to another 24. It's great to meet you. Today it could be spectacular. Let's take a stroll for like 86,000 seconds. Plus a couple more for good measure and then refresh it. Wipe the sleep from my eyes. Hello to another 24. It's great to meet you. Today it could be spectacular. Let's take a stroll for like 86,000 seconds.
Still to come, writer Shaka Senghor talks about being a mentor to troubled youth in his memoir, Writing My Wrongs.
And I think what Writing My Wrongs does is it takes you inside of the thinking of young men and women who are vulnerable, who are caught up in the street culture. And it helps you to understand how they end up in these lifestyles. And once you can understand it, you can fix it and you can turn it around.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Yesterday, we introduced you to James White, a young Detroit man who went from an honor student with dreams of being a doctor to Jay, a crack dealer who murdered a man and then spent nearly two decades in Michigan prisons. Today, that man is Shaka Senghor, a leading criminal justice reform activist, a mentor to youth, and motivational speaker. His memoir is called Writing My Wrongs: Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison. In our discussion, we left off talking about the time he spent in solitary confinement.
It was in that environment that I came face to face with my truest self.
It was, and it's so powerful, as you described, that it finally, you kind of cracked the nut, if you will, and got past the defenses that you'd built up, and you began writing.
Yeah, so my transformation grew in stages. Very early in my incarceration, I was introduced to reading, to the idea that reading was a way to just deal with the day-to-day realities of being inside.
Books were an amazing thing for you, weren't they?
Yeah. And so the first books that I actually read was written by another man who was serving time. And they were these really short books, maybe 25, 30 pages. He was just a great storyteller, and he wrote stories about growing up, you know, on the west side of Detroit. And the stories resonated with me because they was immersed in the culture that I had come from. But after I finished reading his books, he introduced me to a writer who I later learned was from Detroit named Donald Goins, who wrote these really gritty urban stories. And he read probably like 13 or 14 books. And when I would go to get Donald Goins' books, they were in this room where other black authors were at, like authors I had never heard of, you know, Langston Hughes and Claude McKay and Gloria Naylor and the like. And in this room, I just found this amazing world of just brilliant literature. And so I had started reading throughout, you know, that part of my journey. And then I read Malcolm X's autobiography. And that book resonated with me on so many levels.
Why?
Because like myself, you know, Malcolm had grew up in the streets, street culture, and found himself in prison. And he made a conscious decision to turn his life around. And so that became my saving grace. When I was in solitary, I set my days up as if I was at a university. You know, I would get up in the morning, I would study political science 1 hour, then I would go to African history, then I would go to philosophy and, you know, American literature. And I would just study things every day, and then I would write late into the evening.
And the writing really, it's so clear, and that's why your memoir, Righting My Wrongs, talking about the writing that you did, journaling, and just you, so you basically were your own therapist, weren't you?
Yeah, and I didn't realize at the time, one of the things that sparked the writing was I read Socrates' Apology, and in an apology he said, unexamined life isn't worth living. And examining my life, I had to figure out, you know, how did I go from wanting to be a doctor to serving out my most promising years in solitary confinement? And so I began to write a journal. And through this process, I was able to really go back and look at, you know, the child abuse, the child neglect. I was able to honestly look at my mother honestly for the first time. And I was able to forgive her through that process because I realized that she was hurt. And she had been, you know, really, really hurt. And so through the process of journaling, I began to ask myself tough questions, you know, like, what are you good at? And I realized I had never completed anything in my life other than the GED. I realized I had to challenge myself to complete something, to validate my life on earth. And so I challenged myself to write a book, and I gave myself a time frame to write it. So I wrote my first novel in 30 days.
Yeah, you did it. And that sense of you accomplished that. At the same time, it seems from reading your memoir, you got a great big kick in the pants from a letter you got from your little boy.
Yeah, so I received a letter from my oldest son. Now I have a young son. I have a little toddler now. But from my oldest son, Jay, I received this letter, and he talked in the letter about his mother telling him why I was in prison. He was roughly around maybe 8 at the time, and that was a conversation that I just wasn't ready to have with my child. And so when I got that letter, it was devastating to know that she had had this conversation with him.
And he knew you were a murderer.
And he knew that I was a murderer. And so as a father, as a man, as a human being, like, it was heartbreaking to know that my child was seeing me as a monster, because a murderer to a child is a monster. That's the most heartbreaking experience that you can have as a parent, is for your child to see you as a monster. And so his letter challenged me in a way that nothing else had before. You know, it forced me to really delve deep into what had happened, what would he deal with growing up without me being present. And that experience is really what opened up the floodgates for healing.
That, and I'm not going to give it away, but there were a couple of very significant letters regarding the man you killed. Yeah. Ultimately, you were paroled in 2010. And I'm wondering, you talk about life, death, and redemption in an American prison, Shaka. Who was the man who died, and who is the man who's been redeemed?
The man who died was a very broken, very emotionally confused, very angry, bitter young man. Very irresponsible and unaccountable to anybody other than the circumstance and environment that he grew up in. The man that was reborn is a man of compassion, thoughtfulness, caring, a commitment to ensuring that there are no more Jays in the neighborhood. You know, my work today centers around working with young men and women, you know, who are growing up in environments that are very volatile, who are dealing with issues of sexual abuse and child abuse, young men and women who have been thrown away by society. And I love the work, you know, because I see in them, I see myself. And I've been able to use literature as a healing tool for them and to really help, you know, put them on a path that's very different from the one that Jay was on.
So keeping them from getting a prisoner number and giving them the gift of literature the way you discovered it.
Yeah.
But not inside a prison cell.
Not inside a prison cell. So, I do a lot of work inside of, you know, high schools. I speak to high school students all across the country. It's probably my favorite audience. Working with young inner-city kids is, like, the thing I'm most passionate about. But I also work with young men who are in juvenile detention center, because when I was in that environment, nobody ever came in and talked to us. Nobody ever told us that if we didn't make changes today, that we would be on a pathway toward prison. And so every year I adopt two pods at the Wayne County Youth Home. And they allow me to come in and donate books to the young men. And I'm allowed to feed them and, like, share a meal with them. And this is usually during the holiday season, which is the toughest time for anybody that's incarcerated. And then periodically throughout the year, I'll come in and I'll just check up to see if they're reading the books. And I was just there the other day, and I met the librarian for the first time. And she told me that Righting My Wrongs is the most requested book in a library. Her sharing that with me and seeing the impact that the book is having on young men just means the world to me.
I know you're also involved in prison reform efforts. And speaking as someone who has been through 19 years in a prison, what do you think should change? I mean, I guess how do we balance reforming prison with keeping society safe from a guy like Jay was at 19, that guy you once were? I mean, he needed to be punished, didn't he? What did he need?
I don't think he needed to be punished. I think he needed to be helped. We live in a society where we incarcerate more people than the rest of civilized society. And not only do we incarcerate, but we punish, we further damage, and we warehouse. And what I think needs to happen is that we, first of all, we have to really step back and look at ourselves and embrace our own humanity, because punishment comes out of a very dysfunctional space, and dysfunction creates further dysfunction. And so what I envision when you're talking about criminal justice reform is thinking through the long-term impacts that it's going to have on society, that it's going to have on families, that it's going to have on the individuals. Now, I was fortunate that I was literate when I went inside. And I probably wouldn't have been able to do this without being literate because, you know, words opened up my mind and opened up my heart. But when you look at the outcomes, and I'm not an anomaly. Like, I have friends. You know, I have a friend who served 24 years for a crime he didn't commit named Calvin Evans, who was doing phenomenal work in society after serving 24 years. But it's largely because of the work that we did individually and then as friends where we, you know, we held each other accountable. So what I think that we have to do is first we have to decriminalize mental illness. Like, that's a major thing, to decriminalize mental illness. We also have to put in place things that help men and women successfully transition back to society. What people don't realize when they think about the lock them up and throw away the key, there is no locking them up and throwing away the key. 90% of the men and women who are incarcerated come home at some point. So you may lock them up and put the key up for a while, but eventually you're going to have to pull the key out and let people out. And we have a choice in terms of what type of men and women we want to return home. Do we want healthy human beings who have realized that, you know, they've caused harm to other people? Or do we want angry, bitter people coming home? And we've seen it time and time again that when you further damage a person, you don't make society safer. In fact, you create a volatile cocktail that often ends with broken families and dead people. And we can stop that. The idea that, you know, we incarcerate so many people with mandatory minimums and we've taken the power out of judges' hands to say, you know what, well, I can clearly see that this child made a poor decision, and so let me figure out an alternative to incarceration. But instead, judges are powerless. And many judges have gone on record as saying that this is a failed experiment. And the interesting thing about prison is it's the only major corporation, institution, that gets more funding the more failure that happens. So you have a 70% recidivism rate, and then federal dollars are constantly dumped into this system that's proven that it doesn't work. So the work that I do is really evolves around cutting the prison population in half by 50% over, you know, the next 10 years. And it's doable in various ways. For one, you decriminalize mental illness. We cut down on recidivism by offering men and women opportunity to actually transition back to society in a healthy way. We come up with alternatives to incarceration for the majority of crimes that people are sent to prison for, which doesn't quite warrant you been having a felony on your record for the rest of your life. And then we be honest about giving people second chances. So there are impediments in a way for most men and women coming home that include lack of access to employment, lack of access to fair housing. So most people don't realize that if you have a felony, not just if you've gone to prison, but if you have a felony, you can be discriminated against when it comes to renting or leasing an apartment. And you can't expect a person to turn their life around if they don't have anywhere to live that's safe and provides them, you know, just a basic human right to shelter. So there's just a lot of things that I feel like we can address through the system, and this is why I advocate for a complete turnaround in the prison system in the way that we do things now.
It is a very, very powerful, powerful book, Shaka, Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison by Shaka Senghor. Pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to meet you as well, and thank you so much for reading the book, and I'm looking forward to everything that comes later on.
Turn now to Michigan Bookmark, our series where notable Michigan writers review the works of other Michigan writers. Olio is the title of Tahimba Jess' new book of poetry. It's a book of sonnets, songs, and narrative examining the lives of mostly unrecorded African-American performers. Author Kelly Forden has this review.
I first encountered the work of the poet Tahimba Jess back in 2014 when he returned to Detroit to speak to a group of writers at Inside Out Literary Arts. His second poetry collection, Olio, had not yet been published. However, that afternoon he shared some of his work, and I remember leaving the room with the conviction that I had just witnessed pure poetic genius. Jess was born in Detroit. He earned his BA from the University of Chicago and his MFA from New York University. His first poetry collection, Lead Belly, published in 2004, is an exploration of the blues musician Huddy Lead Belly Leadbetter's life and was chosen for the National Poetry Series. Olio chronicles the lives of African-American musicians and performers in the years before and after the Civil War, up until the First World War. The word olio refers to the second part of a minstrel show. Minstrel shows were popular in the 19th century. They featured comic skits, variety acts, dancing, and music performed by white people in blackface for the purposes of pretending to be and often mocking black people. Jess's book is, in his own words, an effort to understand how African-American performers during that period resisted, complicated, and defeated attempts to minstrelize them. Within Olio, Jess records the stories of little-known African-American performers, including the pianist John William Blind Boone, who lost his sight to encephalitis at the age of 6 months. Then there's the Fisk Jubilee Singers and Burt Williams and George Walker, the comedic duo, among others. Although this might be hard to visualize on the radio, I want to try to convey what I mean by poetic genius. Two of the musicians Jess introduces in Olio are the singers Millie and Christine McCoy. Millie and Christine were conjoined twins born into slavery on the McKay Plantation in North Carolina in 1851. Jabez McKay, the plantation owner, didn't know what to do with them, so he lent them out to a traveling freak show. They were talented, though, and later became famous singers in their own right. In order to capture the two distinct voices of these Pygopagus twins, Jess created syncopated sonnets. The sonnets work individually and also in tandem. When placed together on an extended fold-out page, the five poems actually look like the legs, arms, and trunk of a conjoined body. Pretty cool. But that's only the beginning. The reader can choose to read the five sonnets in any direction, from the top of the first poem to the bottom of the last poem, or from the bottom of the page to the top. Want to read them from the right side of the page to the left instead? No problem. No matter where you begin reading the poems, they make sense. If you read them down the left side of the page, you get Millie's story. Down the right side, Christine's. Read the poems straight across, and the two voices form a duet. If Jess had written one inventive poem of that stripe, it would have been an achievement. But that is just a small sliver of the originality you will encounter in this 200-page book. Remember making spyglasses out of construction paper as a kid? Jess's poems about Booker T. Washington and Paul Dunbar are meant to be literally ripped out of the book and rolled into cylindrical spyglasses that can be read on the round. But if you don't feel like folding the poem into a cylinder, how about a Möbius strip or end-to-end to form a geometric torus? Still makes sense. For a better visual, I recommend watching Jess's TEDx Nashville talk on YouTube featuring the Millie and Christine sonnets. Most of all, I recommend this book. As the poet Nikki Finney said, Olio is a tour de force.
Callie Forden is a poet and fiction writer. Her collection of linked stories, Garden for the Blind, was an Indie Fab finalist, an IPPI bronze medalist, a Midwest Book Award finalist, and a 2015 Michigan Notable Book. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.